American Cassette Ministries is pleased to provide you with another presentation from the 2005 General Youth Conference in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Thousands of committed Seventh-day Adventist young people came together as an army on a mission to proclaim the three angels' messages to the whole world in this generation. They believe now is the time.
Let's bow our heads to begin our session today with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, thank you for keeping us safe overnight. We know that every morning that we wake up, it's only because of your mercy and your power. Lord, we don't know what we're going to face in the day ahead, let alone in the year ahead. But we ask you to please come into our lives, direct our lives, take over our lives. Lord, we look around the world and we understand that the wickedness is so prevalent, even to the point where it has infiltrated our church, and even to the point where it's infiltrated our lives. Lord, we ask you to use your power to clean up our lives. Use us as an influence to clean up our church. And Lord, please use this church to help shine a light of righteousness on this world. We ask the Holy Spirit to please come and be in each other of our hearts. Please be in my heart as well as we present this morning. Amen. This morning we're talking about Sunday laws. Sunday laws. How long has it been since you've heard a sermon on Sunday laws? Some of you may be recently. Many of us grow up, we hear about it all the time. Sometimes a rumor comes through our church, we get very excited. It comes and it goes. And here we are, wondering once again about the Sunday law question. Many of you will know that the Supreme Court is currently being restructured. We've had two members who have resigned. And I've gotten a lot of email from Seventh-day Adventists who are saying, it's curious that both of the nominees, now the Chief Justice and the next nominee, Justice Alito, Judge Alito at this stage, we'll see if he makes it to be justice, are both Catholic. And that indeed the Supreme Court will have a majority of Catholics on it. To many people, many Adventists, this is a sign. Sunday laws must be right around the corner. When I first took the job that I have now, which is representing our church on Capitol Hill, a very interesting fax came my way. It was a fax that was attributed to the Christian Coalition. And it said that at their next meeting in Washington, they were going to work towards passing a national Sunday law. This is amazing. It was on stationery from the Christian Coalition. It was signed by someone apparently signed by someone at the Christian Coalition. So I went on their website. I couldn't find anything about Sunday laws. So I called up the individual who was named in the letter. And he said, what? Where did that come from? He said, will you fax it over to me? Fax it over to him. He said, I don't know where this comes from, but this is a forgery. This isn't real. So that's kind of amazing. Kind of an amazing thing. I thought, well, you know, no reason to distrust the honesty of folks in the Christian Coalition, but they had their big meetings, their rally to victory. I thought, I better go down there and just attend. So I did. And I attended and I attended and I attended. I heard a lot of things that kind of made hair go up on the back of my neck. I heard Roberta Combe say that separation of church and state is a deception of the devil, which is kind of an amazing thing when you think about it. But I didn't hear anything about Sunday laws. So I wrote back to a couple of the people who had been agitating about this issue, and I said, been there, check this out. I was at the rally, nothing about Sunday laws. And they wrote back to me, and they said, well, that's because it didn't happen in the main meeting. It happened in a secret meeting. So I wrote back to them, I said, if it's so secret, how come you know about it? Right? That's a good question. and I never got any response back. You know, we're looking at this, and I get this every so often. My boss just came back from Brazil. In Brazil, he was accosted by members who said, "What are you doing to stop the Sunday law that's currently pending in the U.S. Congress?" There's only one problem. It's hard to stop something that doesn't exist. You know what I'm saying? We've been through a number of scares or a number of rumors in our church. John F. Kennedy was seen as a harbinger of Sunday laws. I remember Jimmy Carter being touted as the guy who was going to bring in Sunday laws. Jimmy Carter? Why Jimmy Carter? Because he's an evangelical born-again Christian. That's the guy who was going to do it. Well, they both came and went. Ronald Reagan. Do you remember Ronald Reagan being talked about? Ronald Reagan was the guy who reestablished diplomatic relations with the Vatican. Surely he was going to be the one. And now, of course, here we are at George W. Bush, and some seeing him as the one to bring in Sunday laws. The problem is that we face is that it's well over 100 years since the Great Controversy was written. And here we are with no national Sunday law in sight. Adventists have responded to this problem, this situation. It's not, I guess, not a problem. It's a blessing. It's sort of a problem and a blessing. You know, it's a mixed thing. I've responded to this in three ways. The first is, some Adventists continue to believe that Sunday laws are imminent. There are secret workings behind the scenes, and at any moment, the law is going to be enacted. There are rumors that spread through our church, and for a short period of time, there's intense excitement. And then, of course, the Sunday law fails to materialize. A second group of Adventists have become convinced that Sunday laws are a thing of the past. They don't necessarily doubt the prophetic interpretation presented in the Great Controversy, but they believe it to be a conditional prophetic interpretation. When the conditions failed to materialize, they argue prophetic interpretation became obsolete in the way that many biblical prophecies concerning Israel failed due to their conditions being unmet. They argue that if Christ could have come in Ellen White's lifetime, as she said, but if he did not, due to a failure of his people, which she also intimates, then maybe the end-time scenario that Seventh-day Adventists have held to is also conditional. They argue Christ will certainly come again. There will certainly be a scenario that plays out the prophecies of Revelation. However, it will not be the same scenario that would have played out in the 1800s. I call these people reinterpreters. Reinterpreters. There's a third group of Adventists who believe that the prophetic scenario laid out in the Great Controversy remains current, but that certain prerequisites are required before Sunday laws are passed. They agree that it's most unlikely that a Sunday law would be passed under current conditions. However, they believe that prophecy has mapped out very specific preconditions to the passages of Sunday laws, and under those preconditions, after those preconditions are fulfilled, it is not it's not unlikely at all that Sunday laws will be passed, and indeed that Sunday laws are a prophetic inevitability. I agree with the third group, and I'm going to tell you why this morning. I believe that the Adventist message at its purest and best has always combined rigorous intellectual investigation of a broad array of academic disciplines with in-depth study of the Bible under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. Our findings at their best are expressed in unflinching honesty as we strive towards the goal of discovering and understanding truth, ultimate truth, truth with a capital T. We can't be afraid as Adventists to be honest, because honesty and truth is what this church is built upon. Are you with me? Is a Sunday law imminent? Rumors about the imminent enactment of Sunday laws have spread through our church, and even since I've been in this job for about 5 years, I could count maybe three or four different imminent rumors of Sunday laws that have come through. The problem is that each one of these rumors has inadequate documentation. That is, somebody writes to you and say, have you heard about? Often they don't have a bill number. They don't have a sponsor. They don't have any other details. Somebody has said to somebody, and somebody has said to somebody, and what do you know? It becomes a fact. Just like the game we used to play as children, where we used to spread rumors. You ever play that game? You go in a circle, and all of a sudden, at the end of it, you have something very different from the beginning. The second problem is that if a Sunday law were passed in secret, it would not fulfill prophecy. It would, on the contrary, counter prophecy. Because we are specifically told that Sunday laws will be part of a democratic process that will be drawn out from a popular demand coming from the pulpits from across this country. Friends, that cannot happen in secret. Are you with me? Sometimes these scenarios that I get, these sort of secret conspiracy scenarios I get, it kind of reminds me of that text where the Bible tells you, if somebody tells you Christ is out here in the desert and so forth. Now, of course, we're not saying it's Christ. We're not setting times. But as Adventists, because we believe that Sunday laws are a precursor to the second coming, in a sense, we're kind of trying to set time again by having these speculative scenarios about Sunday laws. Finally, all these rumors to date have been absolutely untrue. The story I told you about the Christian Coalition happened about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago now. Well, where is the Sunday law? Where is it? If the Christian Coalition were going to have someone present the national Sunday law, they certainly had plenty of time to do it and plenty of allies in Congress to do the job for them. Make no mistake about it. This final fact that these laws have not been enacted has created a growing culture of skepticism within our church. I don't know how many of you are feeling skeptical this morning. Maybe some of you are, and maybe some of you aren't. But I can tell you, as I meet Adventists, particularly I think Adventists in their 30s and their 40s, a lot of them are struggling with this. They were told, I got to say, when I was in college, I never really thought about this, because I guess you sort of are at a point in your life where you got a lot of other things on your mind, for starters, and secondly, you haven't had one false prediction after another go through your life. When you get to be 40, you've heard it all 5 times over, and you can understand why people become a little bit skeptical. If our pastor, our academy teachers, for some even our parents, if other pillars of authority within the Seventh-day Adventist Church were repeatedly wrong about speculative Sunday law scenarios, maybe, some think, we're simply wrong about the entire religious understanding. Hence, the speculation among some Adventists, not only ignores important elements of the Adventist prophetic scenario, but I would posit, and not only have they proven to be untrue, which is very important, but they also have a serious negative impact on the faith of many associated with Adventism. So let's look at the three options that we have this morning. Is there a need for a new interpretation of our prophetic understanding? The group of Adventists who reject the great controversy prophetic scenario tend to do so in a quiet, apparently reasoned manner. But their analysis is equally flawed. This is for three reasons. The first is that some who adopt this position do so in a reaction to the speculative excesses that plague our church. But the speculative excesses themselves counter the inspired prophetic scenario we're given. Reacting against statements that violate elements of the scenario by abandoning that scenario in total is a misguided overreaction. One can well reject wanton speculation without rejecting the studied interpretation of prophecy that in fact discredits the speculators' scenarios. Are you with me? You understand what I'm saying here? The second is that many who adopt this position claim simultaneously to believe in the inspiration of Ellen White. Unless one resorts to the most tortured reasoning, however, these two positions are mutually exclusive. Precisely what inspiration means is a debate within a debate. And I'm not going to get into that this morning. But what we can say at the very least is that when a prophet is talking about prophecy, he or she must be able to be relied upon if they are inspired. Right? That's the least we can say. I believe we can say much, much more. We'll leave that for another day. But at the very least, if you have a prophet who prophesies and those prophecies are wrong, what is the point? What's the point? Ellen White, in this case, continued to reiterate the prophetic scenario outlined in Great Controversy until her death in 1915. This is 27 years after the Sunday Law effort of 1888. Now, I want you to understand, as far as I can find, 1888 was the last time we had a national Sunday Law proposed. But 27 years after that Sunday Law was proposed, Ellen White continued to say that it would come and it would be part of the prophetic understanding to the end. If a prophetic scenario was built around events leading up to and culminating in 1888, and if the subsequent to that time the scenario was ripe for reinterpretation, the Lord had almost three decades to communicate this to Ellen White. He did not. It's true that the Bible has many conditional prophecies. This is what the reinterpreters often rely on. But the Great Controversy scenario is very different from the conditional prophecies of the Bible in a number of ways. First of all, when a prophecy is conditional and the conditions are not met, God communicated this to his prophet. A great example of this is Jonah. Remember Jonah? Jonah had to go and warn Nineveh. When they repented, it was communicated to Jonah, wasn't it? Very, very explicitly. In Ellen White's case, almost three decades after 1888, no communication of a conditional prophecy. In addition, no conditions were laid out in the prophetic understanding. There's nothing in the Great Controversy that says, and this is conditional upon A, B, C, or D. There's no conditions regarding if the prophecy would be fulfilled. The only conditional factor related to the prophecy was when it would be fulfilled. Further, God did not provide an indication of a change through Ellen White as he did through Jonah and through other prophets. Further, there is no time period provided for prophetic fulfillment, nor has another prophet risen up to provide an alternate explanation. Now, I want you to think about the prophecies regarding Israel. Think about what God did to make sure that his people understood that these prophecies were conditional. First, you have a time period laid out. A time for Israel to accept God. Secondly, you have Christ coming right before the end of that time period and making very explicit more prophecies about the end of that period when he stands up and he says he's weeping for Jerusalem, how he wants to gather the children of Israel under his wings. Under his arms, like a hen gathers chicks under his wings. And then, of course, after that prophetic period was over, you have Paul and others writing explicitly to explain how the prophecies are now applied to a new group of people. You understand what I'm saying? When God has a major prophecy that is ripe that's conditional. The conditions are given at the outset. When the condition failed, he sent the greatest of all, his own son, to explain why and when. Then after that, you have the Apostle Paul and others there to explain precisely how to interpret those prophecies henceforth. We have nothing like that in the case of the understanding of the great controversy. Nothing at all. In summary, when prophecies are conditional, and when the conditions fail, God has expressed this to his people explicitly in times past. There has been no similar expression regarding the prophetic scenario provided by Ellen White. Either, therefore, it is safe to say if her prophetic scenario was inspired by God, it is still in effect. Alternatively, if the prophetic scenario is wrong, it's impossible to reconcile Ellen White's prophetic gift with being a true prophet if she is wrong about her central interpretation of prophecy. You understand what I'm saying? Either she is or she ain't. And if she is, then the prophetic understanding laid out in Great Controversy is still current. And if she isn't, then it's not. I don't see any way you can hold to her prophetic gift while simultaneously denying the central prophetic scenario she provided to us. It is likely that most Adventists who have come to doubt the prophetic scenario in the Great Controversy have done so because it appears so entirely unlikely at this time in our current social, economic, political, and legal climate. Yes, it's true that there are some indicators that may appear to make a Sunday law likely, but many argue that in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week economy, with so many Sunday-keeping Christians not keeping Sunday themselves, where Sunday-keeping has become very, very marginal in the lives of most Christians, it seems very unlikely. Let's look at illustrate the objections to a Sunday law coming down the tracks. The first is, let's look at the economic implications. How easy do you think it's going to be to get a Sunday law through Congress? Do you think that General Motors is going to be on your side? They're going to say, yes, please, shut down our manufacturing for one day of the week. Do you understand how manufacturing plants work these days? 24 hours, 7 days a week. Any of you ever worked in a manufacturing plant? Yeah, right? 24/7. Most of them are. What about retail? You think Walmart's going to say, sure, close us down one day a week, 14% of our sale time? Or do you think they're going to oppose that kind of a law under current scenario? I can tell you, we're working on a bill called the Workplace Religious Freedom Act right now. And that's not a bill that closes anyone down. It just says, very modestly, to allow people whose religious faith compels them to have time off and to involve on their Sabbath and so forth. Whether their Sabbath is Sunday or Saturday or some other holy day, for example, Yom Kippur, if you are an observant Jew. I can tell you, business doesn't like that law. And it's hard to get a law passed when business is against you. Even though we have 45 different religious groups on our side, everyone from the Southern Baptists, who are the largest Protestant organization in the country, to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, it's still very, very hard. Ask yourself, how would the National Football League respond if you told them that we're going to have Super Bowl Monday now? How about all the theaters and the amusement parks and the other entertainment venues if you told them you got to close down on Sunday? Now, you know, we don't know because we've never had a bill exactly like this, but I can tell you from my experience working on Capitol Hill, I think it's very, very fair to say they would fight it tooth and nail under current circumstances. We also got to look, the reinterpreters point us to the demographics of America, which have changed a lot since the 1880s. And this is reflected in our power structure in the United States. For example, as we noted yesterday, one of the two congressional chaplains is a Sabbath keeper, Seventh-day Adventist minister. Almost inconceivable, incidentally. We've never had an Adventist in the Senate, but the Senate chaplain is a Seventh-day Adventist. It's really amazing. I got to think that God has a plan behind that, because it is just so entirely unlikely. I remember when I first came on this job, there was a debate about whether the Senate chaplaincy is constitutional. I wrote something that said, you know, it's very, one thing about picking a Senate chaplain is that minority faiths never are represented. I had to eat my words, you know. There are two Jews on the United States Supreme Court. There are 37 Jews in Congress, 11 in the U.S. Senate, 26 in the House of Representatives, and two Seventh-day Adventists in the House. Put another way, 50% of the congressional chaplains are Seventh-day Adventists, 22% of the Supreme Court are Jews, 11% of the U.S. Senate are Jews, and 6% of the U.S. House of Representatives are either Jews or Seventh-day Adventists combined. The impact of this is profound, friends. It's profound. For example, in 2004, the Supreme Court decided not to hear cases, not to hear oral arguments on a Jewish holy day in respect of its two Jewish members. And Congress doesn't schedule votes on the first days of Rosh Hashanah and Passover and on Yom Kippur in respect of their Jewish members. What do you think the Jewish community would do if there was a national Sunday law proposed? Well, I can tell you, because I work with them all the time. Some of my best friends on Capitol Hill represent the Jewish community. We not only work together, but we're personal friends. Wonderful people. I can tell you that as things stand right now, they would not be pleased. And if you think that they don't have any influence, you're wrong. They do. Like I said, 22% of the Supreme Court, 11% of the Senate. It's not nothing. It's not nothing at all. Seventh-day Adventists, back in the 1880s, Seventh-day Adventists successfully joined with commercial interests to oppose the Sunday law in the 1880s. Back then, we were a small, marginalized group. Today, we have over 1 million members in the United States, over 1,000 schools, and over 52 hospitals. It is asked, couldn't Adventists working together with other Sabbath keepers, secularists, and commercial interests defeat a national Sunday law under current circumstances? My answer to that is, very likely, we could, under current circumstances. Although, I don't want to be too certain of it. As I indicated, my analysis sometimes is incorrect. Doug has known me long enough to probably know that. Probably Doug Platter and his brother, we've known each other for, what is it, maybe 15 years or so. And he probably seen me wrong many, many times. So it's not only that it's become more complicated to pass the Sunday law, and we have to be honest about this. There's no use denying this in my mind. You can sort of deny reality, but it's not only that it's become more complicated, but it's also that support for such laws have waned. Most Christians don't revere Sunday as they once did. If you don't believe me, just look at what your Christian friends are doing. You ever see the film Chariots of Fire? Do you know what I'm talking about? Chariots of Fire is about a Presbyterian man in the Olympics back in the 1920s who would not run on Sunday because he would not violate his Sabbath beliefs. How many Christian athletes today won't go out there and work on Sunday? I see them on the football field. You know, the whole thing, touchdown. As if, I shouldn't say, maybe God cares about who wins the football game. I have an atheist friend, and he said, I don't know, agnostic, I guess. I don't know much, you know, I don't have a whole lot of understanding about God and what have you, but I'm pretty sure of one thing. If there is a God, he doesn't care who scores a touchdown. Well, maybe we could disagree on that. Maybe he does in certain circumstances if he knows the hair of your head and so forth. But nonetheless, they're out there. It's not like it used to be. People are not, most Sunday-keeping Christians are not keeping Sunday like they used to 40, 50, 100 years ago. They're not keeping Sunday as a Sabbath. You know what I'm saying? Some are. I'm not saying that none are, but not many. Or not as a proportion. It seems odd if when they don't keep Sunday themselves, or it's not surprising, I suppose, that today's Sunday-keeping Christians have not proven keen to enact national law that would prevent many of them from engaging in activities on Sunday that they have done all their lives. Who do you think's running these factories? Who do you think's manning these stores? You know, what percentage of Americans are Christian? Something like 80%. Well, you think it's the other 20% who are keeping Walmart going? Some have pointed to Pope John Paul II's letter on Sunday as call for civil legislation to protect Sunday sacredness, a proof of a growing movement for a Sunday law. Some have pointed to an alternate explanation, and that is that this letter is actually a reaction to the weakness of observance of Sunday among those the Catholic Church claims as adherents. If today virtually no predominantly Christian nations have comprehensive Sunday laws, it's asked, isn't this a sign that the Pope's letter was written from a position of weakness rather than a position of strength? In addition, some have pointed out that the political strength of Christians or the Christian right can be overstated. For example, since the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, the full force of the conservative religious movement has been on stopping legalized abortion, turning that decision back. And yet here we are, 32 years later, and abortion is still legal. And even if the abortion ban, even if the Roe v. Wade was overturned, polls seem to indicate that in most states, abortion would be upheld by statutory enactments. In other words, conservative Christians, for the last three decades, it seems, have lost on one of their most prized issues. We're going to talk about that issue a little bit later on in my next presentation. But it's asked, if conservative Christians can't prevail on abortion in today's environment, what chances are there of bringing the economy to a grinding halt one day out of seven? It's a reasonable question, isn't it? Finally, those in favor of revising the Adventist prophetic position often point to the freedom that a broad array of faiths currently enjoy in the United States. Freedom that is guaranteed by both the federal and state constitutions and by a relatively large body of statutory and case law. My position is, however, that even if we accept all of the above observations of society and the law, it does not necessarily result in the acceptance that we need to reinterpret Adventist prophetic scenario. This is for three reasons. First of all, the above observations are only a partial view of society today. Secondly, the Adventist prophetic scenario is predicated on society changing in radical ways before the passage of Sunday laws. And finally, prophets have insight beyond what is available through reason and observation. Friends, we don't need a prophet if we can just come to this stuff by reason and observation. Are you with me on this? You know what I'm saying? If all you could do is just sit down and figure out what's going to happen, why does God need to send us a prophet? Let's begin by looking at some of the issues in our society and in our law that indicate that Sunday laws are indeed possible even in the United States, even at this time in history. Many Adventists have forgotten, but in 1961, the United States Supreme Court decided two cases that challenged the constitutionality of Sunday laws. Essentially, these cases asked, if the free exercise of religion is guaranteed by the First Amendment, surely no government can make me keep the holy day of somebody else. Are you with me? If free exercise of religion means anything, it's got to be that the government can't force me into a religious observance of somebody else's faith, which resting on Sunday is. Some people have said, well, resting on Sunday isn't necessarily engaging in a religious activity. You don't have to go to church. But if you go back to the fourth commandment, it doesn't tell you that you have to go to church, does it? What's the basic religious observance of the Sabbath?
Rest.
If somebody says, you have to rest on Sunday, they're forcing you into a religious observance. Make no mistake. Whether you don't have to go to their church, whether you don't have to take their communion, whether you don't have to swear allegiance to them, by mandating that you rest on their holy day, they are making you keep an element of their faith. There's no two ways around it. In addition, the question was also asked, how can we have these laws in a nation that says that the government cannot establish a religion? Now, you can argue what exactly an establishment of religion is. We have all these cases about sometimes very trite things, like, oh, can you have a Christmas display on the courthouse steps? Well, honestly, I'm going to tell you something that might shock you. I don't care. You put a creche and a wise man in a public park. You know, if somebody gets bent out of shape about it, you know, honestly, I mean, to me that's very trivial. The ACLU have gone so far as to sue the city of Redlands because they have a little cross in their badges, in their city seal. Well, for goodness sake, that is trite. That is really trite, particularly when you have Christianity as part of the history of the city with the mission down the way and what have you. But these are things that people get very, very excited about. But that's a very small thing, if it's a thing at all. What about enforcing by law a holy day observance? Isn't that a big thing? I would argue that's a very big thing. Well, back in 1961, the court heard these cases. It was very interesting. They went through quite a lengthy analysis, as courts do. In fact, one of the opinions is very, very long. And you have to be very careful about long opinions. Because in order to make black, white, and white, black, you've got to work very hard at it. You know what I'm saying? You have to work. It takes a lot of steps of logic to get from the obvious to the absolutely ridiculous. And that's exactly what the court does. They go through and they say, well, obviously all these laws have language like the Lord's Day or prohibitions against profaning the Sabbath. Sounds kind of religious, doesn't it? Another similar overtly religious language. However, the court found that by the 1960s, somehow these laws had changed miraculously, and now they were simply laws to protect workers' rights. Can we have laws that protect workers' rights? Sure. You know, one of the key things when you're arguing, this is one of the things you learn in law school, and maybe some of you have just learned it innately, is if you can characterize what you're arguing about and what your opponent's position is, if you can win that, you can win the argument. Don't let your opponent characterize, define what the argument is, what the issues are. Define it, and then you can win. They define it, you lose. Okay? In this case, here we are, we're just trying to protect the workers. Can't we do that? Of course we can. We're not trying to enforce religious dogma. Sure, you know, maybe the law says something about profaning the Sabbath, but that's back. That's back in the past. Well, of course, not every lawyer, not every justice agreed with this. One of the dissents, one of the justices in one of the cases, Justice Stewart and Justice Brennan, Justice Brennan incidentally being a Roman Catholic who was very, very helpful on religious freedom issues, maybe not on every other issue, but on that issue, said, I think the impact of this Sunday law upon the appellates, the people bringing the case, grossly violates their constitutional right to free exercise of religion. Justice Douglas dissented in another case, stating, the court picks and chooses language from various decisions to bolster its conclusion that these Sunday laws in the modern setting are civil regulations. No matter how much is written, no matter what is said, the parentage of these laws is the fourth commandment, and they serve and satisfy the religious predispositions of our Christian communities. It seems to me plain that these laws, that by these laws the states compel one, under sanction of law, to refrain from work or recreation on Sunday because of the majority's religious views about that day. Are you agree with that? Well, you agree with the minority. You know what happens to minority decisions? They're there. It's great. It's there. I'm quoting to you. I agree with it. But he doesn't take the day. The decision of the Supreme Court in both cases was that Sunday laws are constitutional. Well, it's over 40 years since that decision came down. A lot of things have changed under the law and society. What's changed as far as this goes? Have these decisions been overturned? The answer is no. Rather, the Supreme Court has confirmed the concept that Sunday laws are constitutional relatively recently. In 1990, the Supreme Court used Sunday laws as an example of the kind of laws that impact on a person's ability to practice their faith, but are nonetheless constitutional. Justice Scalia, writing the majority opinion, I don't know, we talked a little bit about Justice Scalia yesterday, wrote, quote, subsequent decisions have consistently held the right of free exercise of religion does not relieve an individual of the obligation to comply with a valid and neutral law of general applicability. In Braunfels versus Brown, one of the religious the Sabbath cases, for example, we upheld that Sunday closing laws. We upheld Sunday closing laws against the claim that they burdened religious practices of persons whose religion compelled them to refrain from work on other days. This is complicated. I see even one of us has gone to sleep. Wake up, sister. Save your sleeping for later. I know these are complicated terms. We're not dealing with simple stuff, but I was told that this is the intellectual elite of our church. You should be able to handle it. What this decision says is that even as of 1990, the court is looking at this issue and saying past precedent on Sunday law constitutionality remains absolutely intact. There's been nothing subsequent that has overturned those decisions. A recent review of Sunday laws around the country and the District of Columbia, incidentally performed by a Korean-American. You guys are Korean-Americans, aren't you? A University of Virginia law student, one of the brightest young Adventists I've met. She reviewed all the laws across the entire United States, looking at the state Sunday laws at the state level. She found that 49 states in the District of Columbia have one form or another of Sunday law currently on the books. And these Sunday laws really vary. Some of them say you can't sell liquor until after noon on Sunday. Now, why is that? What gets out at noon? Church friends. That's why it's there. Some places you can't sell cars on Sunday. I don't know why. Some places it's this, some places it's that. It's a real hodgepodge of laws. Some places it's very broad, some places it's very narrow. For example, I live in the District of Columbia. It's against the law to do house renovations on Sunday. Well, I did up an 1878 townhome on Capitol Hill, and I'm not confessing to any law-breaking here, but I will say I don't have a whole lot of days outside of Sunday to do home renovations, so don't report me to Mayor Williams, okay? But what I'm saying is these laws are out there. When they have been challenged, the vast majority of them have been found constitutional. Now, just because Congress can pass a Sunday law and that law can be found constitutional does not mean that they have to. You understand what I'm saying? Just because you can doesn't mean you must. The Constitution says what you can't do in this case. It doesn't say that you have to do it. Nothing in the Constitution says you must go out, Congress, and pass a Sunday law. But what it does say is that if a Sunday law were passed, contrary to the assumption of the vast majority of Seventh-day Adventists, there is nothing in the way the Constitution is currently understood that would stop that law from being enacted and enforced. What happens if you have a valid law and you break that law? You can have criminal punishment. There's nothing in the Constitution that's currently understood that would stop that happening. Of course, under today's circumstances, as I've noted, and I'm very honest about this, if I wanted to go out and raise money, incidentally, which I would like to do because we have a very small presence on Capitol Hill, I'd love to raise a lot of money. The best way to do it would be to send out something that says Sunday laws are imminent. I know that. I have one colleague one friend who did one mailing after the Pope's Sunday law letter thing and got more money for what he was doing on religious liberty stuff than he's gotten ever since. I know how to get money from Seventh-day Adventists for religious liberty work. Scare them with Sunday laws. It's true. So there's nothing, it's not an incentive to me to tell you the truth. The incentive to me is to scare you. But I'm not going to lie to you. Why not? Because, friends, integrity and honesty is worth a lot more than a little bit of money. I don't think God's going to bless those who scare people with untrue things. You have to face that, don't you? And I know that if I get up here and I lie to you, I scare you, I give you the most outrageous scenarios, some of you are going to get very discouraged because you're going to come down the line, you're going to say, that guy 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 2 years ago, he told me it's just about to happen. And you know what? It hasn't. And I wonder if the whole thing is just a big hoax. Friends, this whole thing is not a big hoax. We're serious. It's real. And I'm not going to be part of those who are going to scare you with fanciful scenarios rather than tell you the honest truth. There is little evidence today that a national Sunday law is imminent. Even though the constitutional groundwork is there. But friends, the Adventist prophetic scenario is contingent on today's circumstances changing dramatically. If you don't believe me, crack open this Ellen White's books. One thing that I found so discouraging is I go out to churches across this country and I do Q&A sessions, and fully half the questions that I get are questions that every Adventist should know the answer to if you just cracked open the spirit of prophecy. You know, there's two ways to kill a prophet. The first way is the traditional way where you actually literally kill them. And that's what happened to a lot of the prophets, you know. The other way is just to completely and utterly ignore what they had to say. And the best way to ignore what a prophet has to say is simply don't read them. Those books aren't going to jump out and read themselves to you. You have to read them. This is what Ellen White says about the final catastrophe. She says, Satan puts his interpretation upon events. As he would have them, that the calamities which fill the land are the result of Sunday breaking. Thinking to appease the wrath of God, influential men make laws enforcing Sunday observance. This is a reaction to calamities that fill the land. In another place she says, when the angel of mercy folds her wings and departs, Satan will do the evil deeds he has long wished to do. Storm, tempest, war and bloodshed, in these things he delights, and thus he gathers in his harvest. And so completely will men be deceived by him that they will declare that these calamities are the result of desecration of the first day of the week. From the pulpits of popular churches will be heard the statement that the world is being punished because Sunday is not being honored as it should be. Now let me ask you this. Does this seem like a rational thing that could possibly happen? I remember after 9/11, okay? There was an article in the Washington Post about Hillary Clinton and Tom DeLay holding hands and praying in the Capitol Rotunda. And the story sort of concluded that you know that you're in big trouble when Hillary Clinton and Tom DeLay are praying. We were in big trouble. And don't any of us think that we're out of it. We're not out of it. You know, you can agree or disagree with the president, and certainly everyone has their views on these things, but I would say with one thing, he is right. We are in a new world where destruction can come upon us in a way with a scope and a speed that is unprecedented in history. And I don't know when that's ever going to end. Because the technology's out there. There aren't less people who hate us today than hated us yesterday. There are more. We've essentially stuck a stick in a hornet's nest. And, you know. And they hated us before that anyway. So, I don't know what you do. While it's impossible to prove that Americans will pressure Congress to pass a national Sunday law if faced with a series of national disasters of unprecedented scope, it is certainly not inconceivable. In the face of enormous loss, people turn to examine why God allows the tragedy. This happened after 9/11. Remember those quotes from TV pastors that this was a result of in that case it was primarily about abortion and homosexuality. There wasn't a lot about Sunday law, Sunday keeping. But I will tell you something. Well, I'll get to this in a minute. This is also happening after the tsunami. It's also happened after the Hurricane Katrina. But you know, friends, even though the Katrina catastrophe is horrendous, it is not entirely unprecedented. New Orleans, was it 1920-something, also was flooded out, and maybe because New Orleans is a lot bigger city now. The tsunami, maybe it was pretty close to unprecedented. But if you can imagine if 9/11s or Hurricane Katrinas were happening not once a year, but once a month, what kind of result that was going to have? I just was talking with my friend Nick Miller last night, and he asked. We were talking about some of the civil liberties issues that have come up post 9/11. And he knows that I have some friends who work in government, and he asked me why I thought that they had taken such breathtaking steps that regarding monitoring Americans and so forth. And my response is that I think that they think that we are in very, very grave danger of a catastrophic attack like we've never had before. That's what I think. That's what they've told me. I have no reason to doubt them. And imagine, and I don't know when this is going to happen. I don't know if it's this year, if it's 5 years' time, if it's 10, 20. I'm not setting times. I'm not giving you a scenario. But sometime in our future, it's not entirely inconceivable that we have, as the weather seems to be getting wilder and wilder, and as our enemies get more and more sophisticated and technology is out there and proliferating, that we could end up with a series of national tragedies that are just absolutely almost inconceivable at this time in our history. If that happens, I think that people will do what they did after 9/11. Remember how everyone went back to church all of a sudden? Like, all of a sudden, church became hip. Everyone wanted to be in church. Now it wore off because you know something? Fear doesn't change your heart, you know? Love changes your heart. You're not going to be converted by fear. If you're waiting to be like scared to death, it'll last for a little while. If you're really scared, you'll go to church. But it doesn't change your heart. Love does. But if you imagine if we have this unprecedented series of catastrophes that the Ellen White tells us about, the Bible tells us about also. This is not some kind of unique Adventist idea. This is straight there in the Bible. What will people do? What principles will they say that I believe they'll turn to God and they'll ask themselves why God has permitted this destruction to befall our country. And I think many will come to the conclusion that God has permitted the destruction because we as a society have wandered away from His principles. What principles would these be? Many Adventists believe that the evangelical community have forgotten the Ten Commandments. Right? Friends, the evangelical community has not forgotten the Ten Commandments. As Nick explained yesterday, there's sort of a complicated relationship to the Ten Commandments. They want them posted in the courthouse, but they don't want them preached about in the church. But I can't explain exactly where that comes from, but it is. But the recent national focus on the Ten Commandments, I think, demonstrates precisely that they are still interested in them. Sunday-keeping Christians, like their spiritual forebears, speak with passion and conviction of their need for society to reflect the Ten Commandments in their law, in our law, in their national law. And if you don't believe me, just look up all the articles about the Ten Commandments. This is not a dead concept of a bygone era, but a concept that has been remarkably resilient against many predictions to the contrary. Further, the re-emphasis of Sunday sacredness among the Catholic tradition, including the Pope's call for civil legislation, is hard to ignore, particularly in the face of the re-emergency of the papacy as arguably the most preeminent spiritual voice in the world, even in the United States. It is worth noting that the growth of conservative Protestant and Catholic political union in the United States is not so easily dismissed as some of the critics of Ellen White would like to indicate. It's the power of this coalition that elected the current president. It elected the majority in the Senate and the House, and by the end of this year, we'll have had a very influential choice over the majority of the U.S. Supreme Court. And we'll have contributed to the majority control of state legislatures and the majority of state governorships. Now, at this point, I want to make sure that you understand. I'm not suggesting that these individuals are suspect because they're supported by conservative people of faith. I'm not suggesting that one bit. Nor am I suggesting that candidates supported by the secular or the religious left would be preferable. I'm not suggesting that. What I am saying is that the political power of conservative religion in America cannot be so easily ignored. It is there, and anyone who follows American political life today can't ignore it. I can't ignore it because that's where I live in, the bubble of the political realities. The increased power and prominence of Sabbath-keeping in minorities in the United States should also not be overstated. Firstly, many non-Christian faiths don't stress a holy day observance, and many of the non-Christian faiths who do have a weekly or do get together on a weekly day get together on Sunday. For example, Sikhs meet near where I live, and they meet together on Sunday, not out of any kind of religious compulsion, but it's convenient. Makes sense. Also, even though there's a large number of Jews in the United States, according to at least one study, only about 6% of those Jews actually keep the Sabbath. So we can't expect that people to react to a proposed Sunday law in the way that they would now to exist, particularly in times of unprecedented crisis, and we can't necessarily rely on our allies to react with the same level of dedication as we do. Further, the crisis in the Bible predicts that end times will undoubtedly cause havoc among commercial interests, and maybe at that time they will not have the power to resist the Sunday law as they would now. Finally, even if all these contraindications to the observance relied upon observations relied upon by the reinterpreters, even if there were no contraindications, the role of a prophet is to give us insight beyond what we can come to with mere human observation. When Daniel predicted, for example, the rise and fall of empire after empire, There was no objective evidence to verify what he said. In fact, quite the contrary. Who knows who's coming? Who knows who's going? And yet, the word of God was true. Similarly, if we believe that Ellen White's prophetic vision is derived from God, we can be assured of its fulfillment, even if we cannot discern from objective analysis that that fulfillment is imminent. In conclusion, while pushing knowledge forward is the hallmark of the follower of God, While pushing knowledge forward is the hallmark of the follower of God, before we abandon the insights of those before us, we must look long and hard at the scholarship and the inspiration that led us to those insights. In the case of the Adventist prophetic scenario, and particularly the Sunday lore, increasing number of Adventists are erring on both sides. Speculators have got it wrong because they have separated one aspect of the prophetic understanding from its whole. Reinterpreters have got it wrong because they assume a continuum of current events and current circumstances. They focus on a veneer of society rather than looking underneath it. And by necessity, they degrade the prophetic role and actually deny the inspiration behind Ellen White. I would suggest that those who stay the course are right. Our prophetic understanding, understood as a whole, is both true to scriptural interpretation and also true to what we know about society. It's not only consistent, it is the only consistent position with continued faith in God's continuing revelation. The foundation of the scenario is set in law and society today. And the scenario is predicated on unprecedented events that will transform society. I'm looking at the time. I think I need to wrap it up. Is that right? I have more to say about this, but I wanted to give you a very full understanding of this issue. It is my personal belief, and I wouldn't be up there here saying this to you if it wasn't, that the scenario in the Great Controversy is not as likely as it was when Ellen White wrote it, but far more likely than at the time that Ellen White wrote it. It's not going to happen in secret or like that, but with the prerequisites that Ellen White and prophecy and the Bible tell us to happen, I believe it's not only likely, but it is a prophetic inevitability. And that, my friends, is that. Unfortunately, the next session starts, so I don't have a lot of time to answer your questions, but we'll take just a 5-minute break, and then we'll begin with the next session.
For additional CDs of this message or for other presentations by these speakers and others associated with ACM, you may contact us as follows. In the United States and Canada, dial our toll-free order line, 800-233-4450. International calls, dial 717-652-7000. Fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Our internet email address is info@americancassette.org. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our Entar catalog is online, and we accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover credit cards. Maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages since 1975, American Cassette Ministries, a 501c3 nonprofit ministry, is dependent upon your generous tax-deductible contributions in order to maintain our low prices and to continue providing you the finest genuine Adventist preaching until Jesus comes. He's coming soon.